Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today on Stuff to Blow Your Mind, we're going to be starting on an expedition into the history of books. I guess this will be in the spirit of our previous show, Invention. We're going to look at an invention. And I think the book is probably one of the most underappreciated technologies. Obviously, it's not that people don't appreciate books as things. But when we think about books, I think there's a problem that we only appreciate the contents of the books. We only think about them as literature, and we don't think about what a marvelous technology the modern book is.
That's right. Yeah, we basically need to take a step back here before we really get into the idea of the invention of the book. Books are, in the words of Carl Sagan, a means of storing additional information that exceeds the information-carrying capacity of the brain. And I realize that's kind of a simplified version of what they are, but it's also kind of a useful overstatement of the obvious. The book is a tool. It is an extension of the human body in the same way that a normal tool is, but in this case, it is more precisely an extension of the human mind.
Kind of an external hard drive for the brain.
Exactly, yeah. I think this is an example where our tendency to use computer metaphors to understand our own minds is actually pretty helpful. But of course, books are more than that, too. Books are a way for one author or a group of authors or even a legacy of authors to think their thoughts directly into another person's brain. It's a way of not only storing information, but disseminating information. And as such, the books have played a vital role in the spread of information. Where, for instance, would Western civilization be if not for the influx of Arab books into the medieval world? And that's just one example.
Oh, yeah. But I think it's a fantastic example because books provide a way for lost knowledge to be reclaimed, even when knowledge mm-hmm. sort of like fades into obscurity within sort of the oral culture of a society. If there is a book that contains that knowledge, that voice, and the book can be found, suddenly all of that past knowledge can return.
Yeah.
And I think your example is a very good one. Now, thinking more about the metaphor of like the external hard drive or the way of storing information outside the carrying capacity of the brain, in some ways, I think that's a really good metaphor. But there are also very important ways that that doesn't quite capture everything that books can do. For example, a book is a very different kind of memory than a memory in the brain is. And I would say one of the main issues is that books are fixed physical documents, whereas memories in the brain are not fixed. Memories are always changing. Every time you recall a memory, you probably change it in some way. And while, you know, it is possible, of course, to remember things in an accurate way, it is probably not possible to, say, remember the amount of exact numerical figures that would be recorded in a book list of assets or prices, as many, you know, of the oldest books there are, you know, many of the oldest books we have are basically trade documents of some kind, or to remember the exact wording of an epic poem describing a mythological foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, another take on this that I was reading about, I was reading something from Andrew Robinson, author of The Story of Writing. And he points out that, you know, just how powerful books are and how feared books often are, particularly by usurpers of power and conquerors who often burn books. Oppressive regimes ban books. You know, they are powerful reservoirs of human thought. And to your point earlier, I mean, they endure in ways that oral histories often cannot. Knowledge can be lost, but then it can be regained through books. Words and the books that contain them, They freeze our thoughts as well in a way that an oral history does not. The myth that exists within the minds and on the tongues of the people will continue to change, but that which has been recorded, retains all of the curious edges that it had when it was first written down. And you know, I don't recall the source on this, but I remember us bringing up this idea of words and in literature freezing thoughts in the past, you know, that it's taking what is happening in our mind and just and fixing it.
Yeah, I think the example of the way myths change over time is a great one here. Like, it calls to mind the recent episodes we did about the evolution of the Medusa myth. You know, there's clearly some kind of oral history, mythology feeding into the story that became Medusa and Athena, Medusa and Perseus. But once you have a particular author writing their version of that myth, suddenly that version is a fixed thing that can be referred to, and it's no longer just an uncountable part of this protean stew of mythology. Now there is like Ovid's version of the Medusa myth, and that's a thing you can refer to. Now, of course, it's not the case that books never change. I think especially in the ancient world, one thing that's hard for us in the modern world to keep in mind is that books in the ancient world had to be copied by hand when they were, you know, spread about. So changes could easily creep in either by mistakes from, you know, scribes doing a sloppy job of copying or just inserting their own little imprimatur on whatever it is they're working on. That did happen too sometimes, even in, even in very important books like the works of Plato or in the Bible. But there's another interesting thing that I think, you know, you were talking about the political power of books, the way that, like, you know, conquerors and political leaders often like burn or ban books that scare them. There is a power in written documents to create a kind of stability in a political sense, right? Because I was thinking about how a lot of the earliest written documents that exist in human history are lists of numerical figures, like a record of prices or assets in trade or possession, or lists of laws like Hammurabi's Code. I actually got to see the Hammurabi's Code steel in the Louvre recently, and it made me think there about the significance of having a written law code. Now, we might read the laws in Hammurabi's Code and see a lot of brutality and unfairness in there, and I think there is absolutely that kind of thing to find. But you can also appreciate it in a certain way because having a list of written laws as opposed to sort of rule by the ad hoc pronouncements of a leader does, at least in theory, reduce the amount of caprice in how justice is administered, right? Like a written law code, at least in theory, if it's enforced well, allows you to know what the rules and punishments are in advance rather than just kind of like living in fear of whatever the leader's mood is going to be today.
Yeah, yeah, you remove sort of the whims of the tyrant. And also, I imagine, in another level, you kind of remove, like, let's say you weren't even dealing with a tyrant. Let's say you're dealing with just sort of like the traditions and stories of a people, right? You'd have to, like, interpret those to get your laws. But here are the laws in a list. You can, in many cases, you may be able to, you know, to look at it all at once, all 10 things. You couldn't actually have them all in your head at the same time, but they are all on this stone at the same time.
Exactly right. Like, it gives you a common foundation that multiple people can refer to.
Now, I want to get back to the idea of books here before we inevitably dive back through history again. You know, I was thinking about how every now and then you'll hear somebody joke, say something like, remember books when contemplating electronic resources such as ebooks and Kindles and what have you, which, you know, I get that to a certain extent because I know I've and my family have tried to cut down on clutter books in the home. You know, like how many physical books do I actually need? I love books. If left to my own devices, I'm sure that I would have a lot of book clutter. But at the end of the day, you know, is this something I'm going to actually look for? Am I going to actually pull it out and reference it at some point? And or do I have an electronic copy already somewhere else?
Right. You know, well, I've noticed in myself, I at least tend to accumulate kind of books of marginal interest. Like I'll end up with books in my house that are things that there's probably a low likelihood that I'll ever get around to reading them. They're not high on my priorities list and they're just here somehow. Either I got them at work or, you know, that kind of, or they just like looked interesting in a used bookstore one time and it's like, hey, it's 60 cents. I'll get it.
that reminds me of, if I'm remembering this correctly, Umberto Eco had an anecdote about, Umberto Eco, of course, had quite a personal library. I think he had to like reinforce the floor to allow him to keep it. But at some point, some like a workman or somebody had come over and they saw all the books and they're like, oh, have you read all of these? And he said, no, these are just the ones I plan to read, which I see that reflected in some of my own book, you know, collect. You start amassing books and you're like, I haven't read these yet. I would like to read these. And that's why they're taking up valuable space in my home. But I still have a lot of books in the house. And even beyond that, I mean, there are just books everywhere still. Like, there's a library down the street from where I live. There are all these lending libraries, you know. So you're just traveling from here to the library. There are just books, little boxes, wooden boxes filled with, like, various old cookbooks and horror and sci-fi books, that sort of thing. And on top of this, our various ebooks, our PDFs, these are still digital extensions of the idea, the concept of the book. You know, they still obey the laws of the codex. And as such, I think the book will continue to be with us for quite some time. But one of the big questions we're going to be asking in this episode or episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind is, how far back in time would you have to travel, to reach a world in which a book would not be identifiable as what it is?
Well, that's interesting because so the most common form of book that we're familiar with today is the printed book, you know, the product of a printing press. But as I was saying earlier, that's actually a fairly recent phenomenon, for much of human history. If you had a book, that sucker had to be made by hand.
Absolutely. Now, certainly the printed book, as we, you know it, like generally the first thing coming to your mind when I say book, that only goes back as far as the 15th century CE. But while the printing press certainly changed the trajectory of the book forever in ways that we'll come back to, these were certainly not the first books. Yeah, they were before this. We had handwritten books. We had the products of medieval European scriptoriums. And so you might think, well, that's the beginning, right? We go back to the scriptorium, and that would be the beginning of the book somewhere in there. But this would also be incorrect. So to really get to the heart of the book, get to the heart of the codex, we have to travel much further back in time. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break, and then we will begin that journey. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
All right, we're back.
So when we talk about an invention, we like to talk about what came before, what were the prerequisites of this invention, and what were the forces driving it. Now, when we're talking about a book, this is obviously an invention with many forms. What counts as a book? Maybe we can talk about that a little bit more as we go on. Most of us, when we say book, we're imagining what in form would be called like a codex, right? It's bound, it has pages that face in from either side and then are joined at a spine, and you can flip through the pages and read them. But there are other ways of thinking about books, and all of these are, no matter what their form, going to trace back to the original invention of written language.
Yes, and this in and of itself stands as one of the greatest inventions that humans have wrought. Writing systems themselves seem to emerge out of the 4th millennium BCE in Mesopotamia. So just to throw out some dates here, in Egypt, we're talking about 3100 BCE. In the Indus Valley, we're talking about 2500 BCE. In Crete, 1750 BCE. In China, 1200 BCE. And in Central America, 500 BCE.
And so are those different dates you're giving, are those believed to be parts along a spreading evolution of language or independent inventions of written language?
Well, it's interesting. I was reading about this, and apparently some scholars believe writing may have spread from culture to culture, but the majority seem to see it as a situation of independent invention in the various major civilizations of the ancient world and beyond the ancient world, as it becomes increasingly important to record trade data, laws, histories, and more. Coming back again to, why do we turn to the written word? Why do we turn to keeping records of things. So that's where it begins. It's not the composition of poetry. It's not taking our oral histories and putting them down in a solid form. It's initially about the data, about the laws. In a way, it's like it begins with computing, right?
Yeah, I think, what we were talking about earlier, like fixing points of information for future reference so that you can either know something that is beyond your ability to remember in a stable way just within your own brain, or so that you and multiple other people can all be able to point to the same thing and be agreed because it's written in the text.
Of course, the thing with writing is you have to put it on something, right?
Right.
If I take a note about what I need to get at the grocery store and I put it on, say, a Post-it note, great, I have a note, but that's not a book. I can't really make an argument that that's a book, not unless I do some serious folding.
Right, and Post-it notes did not exist in the ancient world. Most of the oldest known written documents of any significant length that still exist today are printed on solid, hard, often heavy surfaces by carving or relief. And so a great example would be one thing I already mentioned, the Code of Hammurabi, dated to around 1750 BCE. This is a law code from ancient Mesopotamia. There was one law I was just looking at in it that I thought was very interesting and related to a recent episode. I believe this is law number 127 of Hammurabi's code. If anyone point the finger at a sister of a god or the wife of anyone and cannot prove it, this man shall be taken before the judges and his brow shall be marked. And the way scholars interpret that idea of pointing the finger is as slander, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But here we get in one of our earliest known law codes, like the idea that pointing the finger is a very dangerous act and it deserves judicial remedy. But so the Code of Hammurabi is carved on what's known as a stele. This is like a large block that cannot be easily transported from one place to another. It's not like a book you can put in your pocket or sack or carry away. You can't store it in a compact way. It's this huge stone. And so a stele was often an official decree or some kind of public document. They would be meant for display to onlookers, often bound to a particular place, and the contents that are displayed on a stele often bear out this usage. So contents you might find would be laws, tomb or grave markers. One example I really like is a boundary stele. We've talked about this in previous episodes, I believe, where you might have in the ancient Near East, there'd be like a marker at the edge of somebody's property, and it might just contain a list of statements on it, like this property here belongs to so-and-so. You can't can't come on the property. If you come on the property, the gods will pluck out your eyes. If you come on the property, at, you know, and then it just like list after, you know, list item after list item of all these like curses that will befall you if you violate this this property restriction.
Yeah, it's a wonderful idea. We need to bring it back.
I'll put one of those in my yard.
If you come on this property without a mask, the gods shall smite you. That episode was, I think we just titled it The Curse, and it was an October publication. And there's a lot of interesting stuff in that. I remember going into some uses of the curse in Chinese carpentry.
There's some
fun examples.
Yeah, totally. But so these types of, you know, writing substrates are things that are going to be big, fixed, usually meant to stay in one place and say something that has to do with that particular place. Another example would be some of these ancient steel, I don't know what the plural is, actually. I should know the steely, stelly, stella, whatever it is. They will like list the exploits of a mighty king and say like all the people that he conquered and all the heads that he smashed.
Yeah, it's such an amazing concept when you really think about it, because it's not just writing down information. Like these large scale examples of this are you're taking this knowledge, you're taking this history or this interpretation of history or propaganda, however you want to phrase it, and you're printing it on the world. You're making it part of the environment.
Yeah, totally. And so I think we should make a distinction here. While I think these early, you know, written documents that are carved on large stones and you know, whatever you want to call the steel tradition, I don't think that's a book, probably. I think for something to qualify as a book, it really needs to include an element of compactness and portability. I think it needs to be something that could reasonably be carried from one place to another and could reasonably be stored in multiples within a building or a home.
That's a fancy way of saying, could you kill a bug with it? Like, if you could not kill a bug with it, I'm not sure it's a book in any way, shape, or form.
I like your definition better.
So let's dive down a little deeper in determining what is and what isn't a book. I of course, turn to a book that I love to dive into anytime we start looking at an ancient invention. That is The 70 Great Inventions of the Ancient World, edited by Brian Fagan. And the contributor in this book for the chapters dealing with writing and encryption and the history of books is an individual that I already mentioned by the name of Andrew Robinson, who wrote The Story of Writing, Lost Languages, and The Man Who Deciphered Linear B. So I want to read an excerpt from Robinson's work in The 70 Great Inventions of the Ancient World. Quote, "There is nothing in the concept of the book that requires it to consist of pages, with text printed or written on paper, still less sewn or glued together between cardboard covers like present-day examples. A cache of Babylon clay tablets, an Egyptian papyrus roll, a vellum codex from medieval Europe, a folding Maya codex with jaguar skin covers from Central America, a microfilm, and an electronic book all qualify as books as much as printed paper volume." And when I was reading this, it instantly brought to mind the concept of a physical book as presented in Frank Herbert's Dune, which, of course, takes place in the far future of humanity. I don't know if you remember this, Joe, but there's this concept of first of all, film books, which are described as shigawire imprints used in training and carrying a mnemonic pulse.
Well, that clears it up.
Yeah. Ignore that part, but because there's also mention of an old-fashioned book, but with a futuristic twist. It's an old orange Catholic Bible that a character gives to another, and it's made for space travelers, we're told. It's printed on filament paper that you can't actually touch. It has its own magnifier, and it has an electrostatic charge system. So the charge holds the book closed, forcing against spring-locked covers, we're told. You press the edge of the book, and the selected pages open. The magnifier slides into place, and you can move it ahead page by page in this fashion without ever touching these like super delicate pages. I remember reading that for the first time as a kid and just being like blown away by this idea of this this tiny little space Bible that has its own magnifier, and it's it's using this electrostatic charge system to turn the tiny little pages.
So it's kind of like a combination of a book and a microfiche, but it's like it's got its own reading apparatus.
Exactly, yeah. But I want to come back to what Robinson was talking about. He's sort of rolling out what he sees as the criteria for calling something a book. Quote, "They are all made for public circulation, enjoy a considerable degree of permanence, and are relatively portable compared, say, to a monumental inscription. Through their different media, they are all capable of knowledge transmission transcending space and time. Of course, printing with movable type, which was invented much later than the book, vastly increases its potential readership, but it does not define the concept."
Well, there's something he kind of hints at in the last sentence there, which I find interesting, which is the idea of a possible link between the mass production of books and people's ability to read books. Because another thing, we talked about how for most of human history, books were not mass produced. They had to be copied by hand. They were precious and rare things that were difficult to make. Obviously the only people who could afford to have them would be like institutions or very rich people or monasteries, that kind of thing. But also, for most of human history, most people have been illiterate. It's only really in the past couple of centuries that widespread public literacy has been a goal.
Absolutely, yeah. So you have to ask yourself, obviously, a book that cannot be read is still, for the most part, a book, but by some definitions, maybe not. Like, for instance, we discussed the Volnitz manuscript in the past on the show, and its unreadable nature that continues to intrigue and confuse us, if the book cannot convey information, if the book is mute, what does that say? I feel similar ways about, say, like if Wu-Tang puts out an album that only one person can listen to, or John Malkovich makes a film that nobody can watch for 100 years. Like, is that really an album? Is that really a movie? Because, this is like a communication has to take place for this to really be media in certain respects.
Yeah, I agree. It's an interesting way of thinking about it.
So Robinson goes on to just briefly outline some of the core examples of early things that we could say were books. So the two earliest contenders that he highlights, first of all, Mesopotamian clay tablets. These would be handwritten, cuneiform script inscribed in clay with a reed and then baked. And then the other one that's one of the two contenders here is Egyptian papyrus rolls, written in ink with a brush. The papyrus itself, this was made from sheets that were made from the papyrus plant. So stripped, sliced, overlapped in layers of pith, pressed, and then allowed to dry.
And I'll come back to this one in more detail in a bit.
However, three other innovations that are worth highlighting. Chinese bamboo and wooden slips bound together with cords. This basically constitutes the idea of a book. And of course, the Chinese would go on to invent paper itself in 105 CE. And from there, it would spread through East Asia, though it would be nearly 1,000 years before Europe followed suit. You also have Mediterranean writing tablets. These would consist of 1 to 10 pieces of wood bound together by a clasp or hinge, or alternatively by a cord strung through holes along the edges. And then you also have Greek and Roman wax writing tablets. And of course, they also use papyrus and parchment rolls as well. And of course, all of these examples of what we might call books were leading up to what we refer to as the codex, in which a number of sheets of parchment are bound together with writing on both sides of each sheet.
Yeah, and it's really the codex, I think, that is the first thing that we recognize as is morphologically the same as the modern books that we have, despite changes in materials and stuff. The codex is what you're thinking of when you think of a book. It folds, it has pages, you leaf through the pages to read.
Exactly.
So I was reading an excellent brief overview of the history of things leading up to the Codex in a book called The Book, The Life Story of a Technology by Nicole Howard. I think this was released at some point through Johns Hopkins University Press. But Howard's overview is interesting. So she mentioned some of the same things you're talking about, of course, that, in the early archaeological record of written documents, hard surfaces rule the day. And of course, these would include like the steel that we mentioned before, and the, you know, the Mesopotamian clay tablets, the what the Assyrians, the Babylonians used to preserve written information, and the, you know, making indents on clay tablets, but also things like wood and bone. She also mentioned several other substrates that I thought were interesting as surfaces for writing on, including ivory, tortoise shell, linen, palm leaves, and what's called bast fiber, which is a tough fiber from the vascular tissue of some plant species, which is often used to make things like rope or matting. And she identifies the most direct ancestor to the modern hardware of a book, a bound book with pages, as what emerges in northern Africa around 2600 BCE. I've read some other estimates putting it earlier, around 3000 or 3100 BCE. We don't know exactly, but of course, whenever it did emerge, this was papyrus. And it's time to sound the alarm. We got a Pliny of the Elder alert. Are you ready for some Pliny?
Yeah. Let's touch in with Pliny the Elder for a little history here. But first, we should probably take one more break.
Oh, okay.
We're gonna jump out, but then we'll be right back in with Pliny.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. So we're jumping in with Pliny the Elder and his description of the ancient papyrus industry. So Pliny the Elder, of course, was a first century Roman military officer and author, encyclopedist, president of the Lead Acetate fan club, of course. He wrote at length about what he believed on the history and production of papyrus. And this would be I'm going to read a section here from the Bostock and Riley translation of Pliny's Natural History, which is his big encyclopedia. It's got all the info you'll ever need. So Pliny writes, "We have not as yet taken any notice of the marsh plants, nor yet of the shrubs that grow upon the banks of rivers. Before quitting Egypt, however, we must make some mention of the nature of the papyrus, seeing that all the usages of civilized life depend in such a remarkable degree upon the employment of paper, at all events, the remembrance of past events." So he's talking about the translation there uses the word paper. Of course, this is not exactly what we'll talk about when we get into the Chinese papermaking tradition. This is papyrus, a slightly different thing, though it's sort of paper-like. He calls papyrus that commodity by which immortality is insured to man. So Pliny's ranking papyrus up there as like one of the most important inventions in Roman civilization. He's like, hey, without papyrus, basically like we couldn't have a civilization. We couldn't have remembrance of things past. Mm. So he goes on to introduce the plant by saying, quote, "Papyrus grows either in the marshes of Egypt or in the sluggish waters of the River Nile when they have overflowed and are lying stagnant in pools that do not exceed a couple of cubits in depth. The root lies obliquely and is about the thickness of one's arm. The section of the stalk is triangular and it tapers gracefully upwards toward the extremity, being not more than 10 cubits at most in height." And then Pliny goes on to explain the way that papyrus was made. This is coming sort of from Howard's summary. Basically, you would cut the plant into segments and you would remove this outer green rind to access the pith inside, which is this pulpy substance. It's made primarily of cellulose. Cellulose, of course, is fiber. And then the pith would be laid out in these long, thin strips on a damp table or board and hammered flat side by side to form these single-layer sheets. And then a second layer of strips was laid flat perpendicular to the first sheet and then also pounded or pressed flat. And Pliny claims that these perpendicular sheets were, quote, "moistened with Nile water, a liquid which, when in a muddy state, has the peculiar qualities of glue." Hmm. Now, Howard mentions that modern scholars do not think Nile water was actually used as a glue here. Instead, they think that the glue would just be a natural property of these plant fibers. There would be a sap in the reed, and that sap would bind the sheets together once they had been pounded or pressed in a perpendicular fashion.
Yeah, so Robinson writes this as well, that it's the naturally occurring sap.
Yeah. But either way, you would then dry the sheets. And so an individual sheet of papyrus might be small. It just might be, you know, around 12 inches in height. But what you could do is glue sheets together at the edges. And then once you've attached a bunch of papyrus sheets together, they can be rolled up into scrolls. And scrolls, of course, are an important book technology that precedes the codex. And we can explore that more as we go forward. But Howard points out an interesting side effect of the production process. She says that by hammering the strips together in this perpendicular fashion, this was actually important because it would allow you to get a much more durable material, right? The paper will be flexible, it'll be fairly tough, you know, because you've got this crossing here. But also as a side effect, you'd get one side of the papyrus sheet with natural fibers running top to bottom, while the other side would have fibers running horizontally. And this has practical implications for writing. The side with the fibers running horizontally was fairly easy to write on. You know, think about like lined notepaper, right? But the side with the fibers running vertically was often considered unfit for writing. It was difficult to write on. And a lot of archaeologists have found that in the ancient world, a lot of people just didn't write on this side of the page, which is very interesting because, you know, when you consider writing material as a relatively precious commodity compared to how, you know, cheap and easily accessible paper is today.
Yeah, I don't. It's almost like they were natural. I find with children, it's similar. Like you have to remind them, hey, the printer paper doesn't grow on trees. So please use the back of the printer paper when you were, you know, sketching monsters and whatnot. But because their natural instinct seems to be just to do the front and just leave it at that. I don't know.
But no, my marker bleeds through. I need to have, you know, clean monsters on either side.
Yeah. We may come back to this in a bit, but I'm earlier I mentioned how like our e-books are essentially the codex, you know, in e-form. But of course, I should probably add this because I know a lot of people may have been thinking this as well. You know, it depends on how you have your viewing settings in place. For instance,
the notes that
we are using here, mine are currently in a PDF form. So I'm reading it in Adobe Acrobat Pro. And currently it is scrolling. Now, there is a separation between pages. So it's like I have scrolling pages. However, if I go to my view settings, I can change that. I can remove the space between the pages and turn it into essentially a digital scroll. Instead, I'm doing something that is, I think, ultimately more like a codex. And you can even, you know, of course, do things where you have like opposing pages and all as well. So I don't know. Maybe we are living in an age where there's maybe a preference for the codex, but we certainly have scroll-like options available to us as well.
Yeah, I see what you're talking about. I mean, this isn't the first time I've heard this, actually. I remember many years ago watching some interview where the literary scholar Harold Bloom was in a characteristically grumpy fashion, lamenting the rise of the idea of ebooks. He just seemed to hate this idea. And the way he described it was like 2,000 years after we made the transition to the codex, finally we are transitioning back to the scroll. And he thought this was just awful. Not saying I necessarily agree with that sentiment, though there is something about like scrolling down to read an article, say on a website, that I don't really like as a reading format. Like it is more pleasant to have the same article in a format where you can just turn the pages.
I like the sequential nature of page turning.
Yeah.
There's something, I mean, maybe it's just too elementary, you know, that it feels like I'm taking care of a task one after the other, one page at a time, in a way where an endless scroll might seem intimidating. I don't know. Or maybe it's just this is what I'm used to and this is what I like to do. Because like when I'm using my Kindle, there's certainly more of a feeling of side to side, page to page. And, you know, you'd even have some sort of a page count up there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so interesting side fact, Pliny notes here. Pliny starts describing a bunch of different kinds of paper. He's like, now I will tell you about the 9 different kinds of papyrus. thanks, Pliny. But he mentions one kind. He's talking about the Egyptians describing this high-quality white papyrus as what's called hieratic, or this is sometimes translated as holy paper, since it was reserved entirely for the use of religious books. And the footnote in the Bostock and Riley translation of the Natural History says, quote, "The priests would not allow it to be sold, lest it might be used for profane writing. But after it was once written upon, it was easily procurable. The Romans were in the habit of purchasing it largely in the latter state, and then washing off the writing, and using it as paper of the finest quality. Hence it received the name of Augustus, as representing in Latin its Greek name Hieraticus, or sacred. In the length of time it became a common impression, as here mentioned, that this name was given in honor of Augustus Caesar." But I think that first part's interesting. So like if their characterization is correct here, that like certain kinds of papyrus were guarded in a material sense and regarded as holy because they would be used at some point to write holy scripture on, not because anything had been written on them yet. But then once something had already been written on them, then it was no longer sacred, and then you could easily just get it and, I guess, wash off the holy scripture and write whatever you wanted on it.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. That reminds me of the, I think it was a two-part episode, maybe it's just a one-part that I did with Christian back in the day on the idea of grimoires, of, mm-hmm. you know, books that end up taking on sacred qualities, you know, generally because of the sacred contents that they have. I remember there being one, we were talking about a cache of Qurans that had been discovered. And part of the issue was like these books, these holy books had been used and reused to the point where they were kind of falling apart. They weren't really usable anymore. They weren't presentable, but they were also sacred, so they couldn't be destroyed. So they were kind of walled away in a building, and then they were discovered much later. And I, if I'm remembering correctly, you know, they gave us some of the oldest examples of the Quran that we have been able to acquire. So yeah, when you start getting into the idea of sacred information put onto a material that may itself be considered sacred, everything gets very complicated.
Yeah, that is interesting. Like the conceptual contagion, that the sacredness of the content of what's written on the paper or the papyrus or the ink or whatever eventually extends by contagion to the physical form itself. It's not just that what is written in here is holy, but like the actual physical book is holy.
This is such a weird concept. Like, it seems like the kind of thing that might be utilized by like an artist. Like, what if you had a Bible, okay, like a Catholic Bible, and you found out that it was made from 100% from paper that had been recycled from pornography? How would we deal? Like, I don't think we would particularly, like, it would be a weird thing to focus on today. It would also be weird that you were, you know, making it exclusively from pornography recyclings, but would that begin to sort of creep into our idea of contagion, that like this book is profane? It's some sort of a blasphemy because you made it on such recycled material?
I feel like a lot of modern religious people would probably house the distinction in the intent of the person who made it. So it'd be like,
true.
Did you know you were making it out of this recycled paper or not? Like, it, I think most people today, like, if they found that out, but they knew it was just recycled paper and the person had no intention of making that particular transition, they wouldn't care. But they might get annoyed at the idea that someone did this on purpose.
Right. Like if it were in a museum in New York City or something.
Yeah.
But then again, imagine this. I can easily see somebody, say like a televangelist, marketing their own Bible that they can 100% guarantee is not made using recycled pornography. And people would be like, yes, how have I been using an impure Bible this whole time? There might be some pornography in there.
Right. Well, I mean, if you got somebody who's good at selling it, they'll be good at selling it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess to get back to papyrus, so how was papyrus written on? Well, Howard mentions that the ancient Egyptians would write on papyrus using reeds or quills, often dipped in an ink made out of charcoal diluted in water. And again, a reminder at this time, we've mentioned this, but if you wanted a copy of a book at this time, it had to be written out by hand. You could not get it from a printing press. And Howard mentions that scribes in ancient Egypt would copy scrolls either by sight, so you just have one copy of a book on, you know, one part of your desk and another a blank scroll on the other part, and you just copy it out by hand. Or you'd have a book read aloud, and you'd have to copy it down from dictation, which sounds even harder. But this was a slow and laborious process, not just for the obvious reasons you might imagine. It would also be slow and laborious to copy a book in this way because there are also mechanical limitations. Like, you had to wait for the ink to dry as you're going, and there's no backspace key if you make a mistake and so forth. But papyrus made out of the reed, the Cyperus papyrus plant, it was a major industry supplying writing material to the broader Mediterranean world. But Howard identifies an interesting shift, and it begins especially around the first century. There's some elements of this shift in earlier centuries, but it really gets going around the first century that there's this long-running major shift from papyrus to parchment for writing material. Now, why this shift? Well, one explanation given by historians is a basic shortage of supply. Again, papyrus writing material had to be made of this specific plant, the reed Cyperus papyrus. And if there was a sudden scarcity of the reed, that would mean a scarcity of the writing material for export. But Howard also mentions that there were sort of pressures put on Egypt by military incursions in the previous centuries. And so whatever the cause of the dwindling supply of exported papyrus, around the first century, bookmaking peoples elsewhere in the Mediterranean were really starting to seek out an alternative, which they found in parchment and vellum. Now, what are these substances? Basically, think like paper made out of treated animal skins. Parchment is made from untanned sheep leather, and vellum is made from calf skin. So to treat these animal skins for use as writing surfaces, first, of course, you had to clean them. You had to get all the biological gunk off, you know, all the hair and stuff. And then they would clean the smooth surface with applications of pumice and lime. And Howard points out that this was a difficult process since the animal skin had to be stretched and dried at the same time. So the goal was to stretch it out in such a way that it wouldn't contract back to its original shape once it was finished drying. And there are actually several ways that parchment and vellum proved superior to papyrus as a writing material. One way is that they can be made pretty much anywhere. Papyrus was dependent on Egypt. It was dependent on this Egyptian industry, especially since it was made from a reed native to the Nile Delta area. Though I think there were papyrus or papyrus-like products also made from some of the Mesopotamian empires based on reed plants from the Tigris and Euphrates. I don't know if it was the same species of plant, but it seems primarily papyrus was coming from Egypt. But nevertheless, the ancient Romans were generally dependent on Egyptian papyrus for their needs. Meanwhile, sheep and calves, they could be pretty much anywhere. They were raised pretty much anywhere, so you could always make parchment or vellum locally. And Howard doesn't mention this, but I've read in other sources that the process of making papyrus writing material was also a closely guarded industrial secret. And I kind of wonder if this might also have proved important in its decline.
Yeah, ultimately, you just need an alternative to that that trade secret papyrus. So, yeah, you turn to, what can I do? What are some other organic sources I can source to turn into something that I can write on?
Right. Now, on top of this, there were some other benefits as well. Parchment and vellum were just more durable than papyrus. They held up better over time and held up against wear and tear better. But finally, there were aesthetic and practical reasons parchment worked better than papyrus. One, it was easier to write on without the facially perpendicular fibers of the plant matter. Once you had written on it, also the text stood out more clearly from the background than it did on papyrus. And to some extent, parchment actually allowed scribes to erase mistakes or other unwanted writing more easily than papyrus did.
I mean, by virtue of it being just more durable, for starters, because we have to remember that I think we went into this when we talked about on our invention episode about the pencil and the eraser. Like, erasing is often a matter of taking away from the material upon which you have written. Mm-hmm. And so if you're already dealing with fragile papyrus, there's just less you can do without destroying the paper.
Totally. So by about the 4th century CE, parchment had replaced papyrus for most written documents in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. And so that's going to play a very important part in shaping the physical evolution of the book, especially once we start talking about the form wars of scroll versus codex. But there's something else we need to get into, I guess, at the beginning of the next episode. I think we're running out of time for today, but parallel to the papyrus and parchment industries being established in those regions in the West, eastward in China, written documents had found a home on a totally different writing material, and this would be paper. So maybe in the next episode, we should start off by looking at the paper industry.
Absolutely. So definitely join us next time as we continue this look at the history of the codex, the history of paper, the history of writing itself, all kind of bound up into, not a single volume, multiple volumes. You can think of each episode of the show as a volume, right? So join us next time. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you know exactly where to find us. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And what can you do to support us? Well, out. You can rate, you can review, you can subscribe.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at CedarPoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.